modesty, for example, I love that lens because I think sustainability has empowered a lot of people to forget about modesty and to be very conspicuous on the basis of sustainability. And I think because this is not a real concept, but more of a direction, we need to be a little bit more humble again and give people more freedom to learn and to show their ideas on sustainability. They may have different perspective on it. I mean, we don't have the authority to judge one over another. Really, we don't.
Hello, everyone. Today I am with Sarah. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Deanne. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you. And you?
I'm good, thank you.
And thank you very much for accepting my invitation. I'm very glad to be with you today.
I'm so glad that you invited me here. I've been following your work for a while, and it is my absolute privilege.
Thank you. And what's good is that with technology, I'm in France, you're in the United States. We don't have the same time zone, but we are still able to speak together. That's so beautiful, I think.
I know, like, I absolutely love that, you know. I mean, I'm going to be talking about Fashion Forward, the think tank that I have co-founded with Doris Domsley-Lentner. But just, you know, like, we do a lot of programming on fashion, and one of the thing is we started in the pandemic, and one of the challenges was how to organize events when nobody can come together. And essentially what we sort of like came to is this very basic realization that it's so amazing that we have all these technologies, for example, Zoom, and be able to get these amazing speakers and fantastic audiences from around the world and across time zones. So in the end, I guess, you know, for community building, there are bright sides.
Yes, very good sides. And could you, to start, could you introduce yourself in two sentences?
Absolutely. My name is Sarah Amelia Burnett. I am the co-founder of Fashion Forward, which is a New York-based think tank. And I am also a strategist and a sociologist from Hungary.
Oh, that's good. Thank you. We will have the time to talk about all those things. But to start, you know that the subject of the podcast is modesty. So what would be your definition of modesty in fashion?
Modesty is putting yourself to the second place, which, I mean, it sounds very obvious, but I've been thinking about this a lot. And I think sustainability is a framework that is becoming really forefront of communication. And that's a very great thing. But it has also came with a moral framework and a moral narrative that reinforces immodesty in a way. In a way that is not based on looks, but more of moral statements and moral identity. So even though fashion, sustainable fashion, tends to be more minimalistic, it tends to be more quiet aesthetically, it is not always paired with modesty. I think conspicuousness appears on a moral base, and I think modesty would help that kind of a sustainable fashion narrative turning into a more inclusive discourse.
And that reminds me of something you told me last time. You talked about social sustainability.
Yeah.
I love that term. So could you like develop on that? What's social sustainability?
Of course. So traditionally, when we talk about sustainability, we consider it to be environmental. That is that we think about how much water we used, what kind of chemicals we use for dyeing materials, what is the physical footprint that we leave behind during production, during consumption, and even after we no longer use a garment. How does it impact the Earth, the planet? And I think like that's a very, very important part of sustainability. But when you look at the very definition of sustainability, it is to preserve society, culture, and the environment in its current state so you can pass it down to generations in an unharmed form. Sustainability, environmental sustainability is just one aspect of it. And I think social sustainability is another aspect that is largely neglected in the discourse. And social sustainability really touches on concepts and ideas such as labor. How do people, how are they employed? How much money do they get as their payments? What is the education that they get access to? What is the healthcare that they get access to? How are they treated in their day-to-day life? What is the representation like? So almost like we need to investigate what are the points where harm could be inflicted on people, not only on the planet, but also on society and society members. And social sustainability is one framework that can help tackle that.
I find it really interesting because now, as you said, we talk a lot about sustainable fashion. But unfortunately, sometimes we can see that some brands are doing greenwashing. And I think if we include the concept of social sustainability more linked with sustainable fashion, it could prevent those like greenwashing type of communication if we link the two together.
Definitely. I think one issue with social sustainability as opposed to environmental sustainability is that social sustainability is harder to quantify. So while with environmental sustainability, you can pinpoint exactly what is the footprint in terms of carbon emissions, for example, with social sustainability, people are relying on storytelling to come to results more, to communicate results. And that is partially because, I mean, of course, you know, like you can disclose salaries and data like that, but in the end of the day, social sustainability comes down to the level of happiness.
Yes.
And how you quantify happiness is essentially ask people if they are or not.
Yeah, that's simple.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, like that's kind of, I think, like a very dangerous idea. It's very difficult to not fully rely on storytelling, and I think one thing that need to change in the fashion industry today is that we have been approaching social and environmental sustainability in general from a storytelling perspective, from a storytelling angle, and that was really great to introduce these needs that need to be met with consumer demands in order to change our consumer habits. But I think a next step in order to really avoid greenwashing is to start providing data. And there should not be any excuses for that. I think brands should be a little bit more daring, a little bit more bold, And even if they don't include those ideas in their storytelling, there should be documents accessible to consumers if, you know, they claim to be sustainable.
So including more like traceability and transparency.
Exactly.
Maybe with technology, blockchains and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, blockchain could be a very great mode for it because the technology essentially allows people to make sure that data was not modified along the lines. But I still, you know, I mean, not every brand has access to high-tech solutions. But every brand has access to truth. You know who you're hiring, you know the conditions, you know payment plans, you know benefits. I mean, that has nothing to do with access to technology. That has everything to do with how much you want to disclose.
And being maybe more human-centric.
Very much so.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the core of sustainability is essentially not to buy more, but to get items that still communicate who you are, because that's, you know, why we are buying things in the welfare society, to establish, maintain, and express identities. So we didn't need those objects that are basically the extensions of ourselves. But those objects should be, you know, I mean, if we can afford buying objects that tell stories, they should also be rooted more in our communities. They should be rooted in human experience. And that is, by definition, I think, sustainable.
And, you know, I don't know what you think about that, but if there's something good about the pandemic we are living right now, is that it has forced us to slow down and to re-question everything and maybe to focus on what's essential and really value authenticity.
I certainly hope so. I mean, I think one aspect of it, the whole lockdown, is that we have started, I mean, that's something, one thing that I see, that looking around our communities and our neighborhoods, and this idea that our dollars are supporting, which is not a new idea, but I think with seeing and experiencing how businesses that are surrounding us are struggling and having a hard time reinforce this idea that dollars are basically votes for ideas and people behind brands. And that's a very important aspect of consumption, modern consumption.
Exactly.
And I think, like, that's really the core of authenticity. That there is an element of truth to it, and storytelling is really rooted in human experience and imperfection. And I think it's going to be interesting in the next couple of years to see how brands embrace that in a way that they still remain aspirational. And the imperfection is not a calculated aesthetic, but actually something that caters to more humanness.
Yes, yes. And even if we talk about, you know, being like more, having more sustainable practices, nobody's perfect. So you can't go from one place to another like right away. So it will take time, but just showing that you are trying your best is the most important thing, I think, even if you don't do everything perfectly.
I 100% agree. And I would like to emphasize this idea that many times I think in current culture, we talk about sustainability as if it was sustainable fashion, for example, as if it was a real thing. But in fact, there is no such a thing as sustainable fashion. I mean, it's more of a goal. It's a direction to go towards. Yes. There won't be anything that is 100% sustainable from every single angle. So I think that's why modesty, for example, I love that lens, just to go back to for a second, because I think sustainability has empowered a lot of people to forget about modesty and to be very conspicuous on the basis of sustainability. And I think because this is not a real concept, but more of a direction, we need to be a little bit more humble again. And we need to give people more freedom to learn and to show their ideas on sustainability. They may have different perspective on it. I mean, we don't have the authority to judge one over another, really, we don't.
Yes, we can just focus on ourselves, our actions, and just try to be a better person every day.
I agree.
And if we talk more about your educational background, what did you study?
Yeah, so I have a little bit of a... I was born and raised in Hungary, and when I was 18, I got into fashion modeling. I moved to Paris, and I just sort of like fell into fashion. And I decided to go back to college. I just really missed studying. I missed learning. But because I had already that background in fashion, I wanted to utilize it. And I did communication and psychology at the American University of Paris. And after I graduated, I have studied fashion marketing.
You are going very, very fast. Let's talk about like when you were living in Paris. First of all, do you speak French?
Oh, my French is really bad. And I just had French class, actually. And oh my gosh, like it's so easy to forget a language. It's painful.
And how long did you live in Paris?
So I moved there when I was 18, and I worked as a model for a couple of years. I sort of like traveled, went off and on, and then I lived in Paris for 3 years during college.
And talk a little bit more about your modeling career. Like, did you like it? What lesson did you learn?
Oh my gosh, yeah. So I almost feel like it was a little bit of a different era, even though it wasn't like that long time ago. I'm not that old. I'm 34 now. But I did modeling from 2005. And that was the time where we didn't have the smartphones yet. We didn't
no
have
Facebook,
Instagram.
No Instagram.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So like none of those. And I remember that on the one hand, it was an amazing experience because I was fortunate enough don't think I realized it at the time, how fortunate I was. But I did do all the shows, you know, like I got to meet Karl Lagerfeld when I did Chanel. The couture shows, which is, you know, like just to be around this legend for a short time, it's fantastic. And these publications like Vogue or Elle, Marie Claire, shooting around the world. I mean, that was something very, very special, which at the time it didn't feel as special as now in retrospect.
Why? At the time you didn't feel good, happy? Because it's said that there's a lot of pressure on models that you need to be thin, you can't
eat. Yeah. I mean, like the whole idea of just like being super skinny all the time, that was something always very difficult for me because I love, love, love to eat. And I just like everything about eating I love. So that was like definitely something of a constant pressure. But Moreover, I think what was very difficult for me is that constant loneliness and constant solitude. Because you are alone in different places. You may go to Tokyo for a month, and then, you know, like to Spain for a week. And, you know, like, it's just like super amazing that you get to do all that traveling, but there is nobody to share it with. And you don't have a sense of community when you arrive to a new place. And you only work with people for a day at a time, which is not enough to develop relationships. So that was something that I think in my generation we were struggling a lot with, as opposed to today, where with social media, it's, I mean, social media has a lot of weak points, but that's one thing that is super great, that you, it's just easier to stay in touch with people. Now you have, you know, like Bumble and I don't know what are the other apps, but there are, you know, like apps to make friends essentially when you're in a new town.
Yes.
Which is just amazing that, you know, like you can go grab coffee with a person because, you know, like you may be new in town and you don't know anyone and why not? So I mean, those were tools that we didn't have at the time and that was rough. But at any rate, I think just to be able to soak in fashion cultures in such an organic way was a true gift.
So you like the fashion industry you were introduced to?
Not at the beginning. I'm coming from an artist family. My father is a writer and my mother is a stage actress. And their friends, their community, they're kind of like these artists, intellectuals. And so modeling was almost like a curse word at the time. You know, like
really?
We didn't have, yeah, like we didn't have those magazines. Like I was, so Hungary, I was coming from this like really right after like post communist era where we didn't have the cool magazines. Like modeling was something very suspicious, something that was very much about the looks. Fashion was also something very frivolous. In the culture, it was regarded as something that was rather superficial, that was not about depth, that was not about ideas, that was not about innovation. It was more for people who just want to, like, basically, like, for showiness. So I was very resistant when I got into this fashion platform because...
And sorry, how did you get into modeling? Did you want to be a model or you just got scouted by someone in the street?
So one of my mother's friends was really pushing me to... or pushing my mother to let me do modeling. And my parents were resistant for a while. But then, you know, like it just provided such a great opportunity to be traveling the world and to make money that was unimaginable in Hungary at the time, that eventually somebody in the friend network had suggested that there was a casting by this agency who is based in Paris, New York, and Milan, and they're doing a scouting in Budapest, and that I should go and meet them. And I remember I was, you know, like it was that one day I was coming out of school, and like I kind of wanted to meet them because I wanted to travel and I wanted to sort of like explore the world, but also I didn't even like change into like a dress or high heels because I was not taking it seriously. Like I don't think I was prepared what the fashion world was like.
So you were not a fashion person like when you were young. You didn't like, you wasn't following the fashion shows and stuff like that.
No, I mean, I was really not coming from a culture where this was seen as value. And I don't think like I became enthusiastic about fashion even until I think like I got to university. And then I realized that, you know, actually fashion is such an important part for culture and society and for psychology and the self. It has tremendous power to help define and articulate for people who they are. It holds power on a social and on an economic level that is really not to be neglected. I mean, it even today it renders groups of people who are seen more worthy and who are seen to be more valuable just based on fashion, just based on what you look. Even before you can introduce yourself, people make assumptions of what you must be like as a person,
but that's
what your
bad.
Capabilities are. It is bad, but that's just how humans work, you know? And that's why we should not ignore and neglect fashion as something that is, you know, not serious. It is very serious.
So after your 3 years of modeling in Paris, you studied in Paris. I forgot. What did you study?
Yeah, so I did 3 years of modeling, like very high fashion modeling. And then I got to school. I did communication and psychology. And at the time, because one thing that not a lot of people know about modeling is that it takes a long time and a lot of investment in the sense that you need to shoot a lot of magazines that are not paying a lot, but because it gives you credibility that you are a good model. So even if you're not paid monetarily, you do get that are essentially PR material for money jobs. And when I got to school, I didn't have that time anymore to do that. So I got into more commercial modeling, which is really great because I got to see another aspect of fashion while I was studying communication psychology. And then I have went on to study fashion marketing at Parsons with a continuing education program.
It was in France or
It was in France. And then I did a brief internship with a branding agency in Malaysia. I sort of like traveled around the world for a year. And then I went to do my master's.
What did you do in the internship exactly?
So I stayed in luxury, not so much in fashion, but I did luxury. And I was working with this branding agency who had several accounts, but mostly for different marketing initiatives. So I helped, you know, proofreading and pitching different strategy meetings. Basically, you know, like help whatever I could around and just observed how an agency like that works.
And did you like this experience?
I really did. I really did. I really like to work with creative people.
What did you learn that you didn't know?
I'm not sure if I can answer that question based on skill set. I think what I really did learn is that I really enjoy strategy work. But I need to know more about the frameworks and I need to gain different tools, because one thing about having a liberal art education is that you gain critical understanding. You are able to understand motivations, cultures, societies. You are asking yourself questions, but you don't really have a tangible skill set. when you come out of it. It's not like you can actually do a job. Like, it's more of a critical thinking exercise in some ways. So, I mean, those experiences made me realize that I want to do something that is more practically based, that is still in fashion. And around that time, I have discovered this program in New York City at the School of Visual Arts that focused around branding. And at that time, I didn't know that much about branding, but what it appeared as this discipline that sits on the intersection of culture, anthropology, psychology, business, and creativity. And that was something that really appealed to me, because I didn't want to just stay in social sciences. I also didn't want to stay just in business. It was something that was so multidisciplinary that I wanted to be part of. So I have applied and I was accepted. So what came after was a year of extremely intense programming, where I was able to learn about these different disciplines, from trend forecasting and culture analysis to the different nuts and bolts of branding, to storytelling, strategy. I mean, really all aspects of branding, research design, everything you can imagine. And that was just, you know, like a fantastic, extremely inspiring 1 year. And at the time, I also started working on this project that was called the 100 Days Project. And my 100 Days Project focused on the meaning of luxury. And throughout 100 years, oh my gosh, like that's probably what it felt like at the time, because it was so intense, but it was 100 days. Yes. I was asking people what their definition was of luxury. And that led me to do a PhD program in the consumer motivations behind luxury and luxury fashion.
That's so interesting. And what was the results in general? What people said about luxury?
So, I mean, luxury, traditionally, when you look at it from at least the Western perspective, is very restricted socially. Just, you know, like when you look at, for example, the Middle Ages, in the West, you see luxury concerning just the aristocracy and the church. I mean, that's, you know, like those are the areas where you get access to luxury. So, I mean, it's like basically two different definitions. And then how, as the time goes, and there are more and more classes that have access to consumerism and more sophisticated forms of consumerism, the needs that lay behind this idea are diversifying. And I think we are at a very interesting stage today, because we no longer accept what those handful of luxury brands tell us what luxury is as a concept and an experience. But what you can see is this fragmentation, this diversification behind what we believe to be luxury. So just to put it in a more tactical, more tangible way, if you ask somebody who is working in the Silicon Valley, for example, who is maybe, you know, like 35 years old, works with tech, makes a crazy amount of money, will probably have a very different definition of luxury and very different hopes and concerns than somebody who has aristocratic roots, lives, you know, in the UK, still centered around this idea to preserve tradition and heritage that were passed down through generations. And also, that definition is going to be very different from somebody who is, I don't know, 22, a pop star from South Korea, for example. Obviously, like my examples are very stereotypical right now, but you get the drift. These groups are insanely different in terms of their aspirations and their desires, both functional and emotionally. Nevertheless, they still do belong into the same wealth cluster that allows them to buy expensive items and experiences.
That's interesting. And so you did your PhD on this idea of luxury that you developed?
Yeah, so I did my dissertation on that. I'm still waiting for my defense. But while I was working on my dissertation, at the beginning I was very interested in this idea of the democratization of luxury, because at the time, about 5-6 years ago, that was, you know, that was the thing that everybody was interested in. Can we democratize luxury or not? And as I went, I sort of stumbled upon this new idea that was so unheard of and exciting and fresh, and that was called sustainable luxury, which is now, 5 years into it, the thing that everybody is doing. But at the time, it was, you know, this overlooked, very neglected, just emerging little idea that I gained interest in over time.
And after your PhD, what did you do?
So I have started, for the last 6 years or seven, I have been also doing brand consulting. I do a lot of strategy work, helping brands how to define who they are and how to put those ideas into practice. I have been working with a lot of luxury companies, but also with fashion companies in training and in consulting.
And you know, there's something I wanted to ask you. In terms of branding, what would be the most important keys, in a few words, to have a very good branding?
I can only quote Debbie Millman, for whom a branding is deliberate differentiation, because that's really what branding is. To make sure that your story is different from the others. That is branding.
That's really interesting. And that's even more interesting because I don't know if you have this feeling, but sometimes it seems like some brands look the same. You know, and even I don't know if you saw that about the logos, all the brands changed their logo into a more standard.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
You
oh,
saw
it's
that?
Crazy, yeah. I mean, that's interesting. There are trends, but oh yeah, I mean.
But how come?
I mean, it's a very good question. I think like in every era, every time, there are trends that people gravitate around, that are culturally more aspirational, that translate design aesthetics, that translate philosophies into more material expression. But I think also we live in this era where we are so deeply rooted in consumerism, we don't even realize, and we have this very paradox relationship to that, that on the one hand, we want to detach ourselves from brands, and we are telling ourselves that we do not need branded things, but we still gravitate to them. And I think one example for this is actually those logos that we don't want to be flashy and we don't want to be too different, but it is very difficult to be unbranded in today's world, where brands are telling your story to other people.
But it's bad because I had the feeling that some brands, by just being the same in terms of typography, were losing something. You know, all those brands, like I think even French brands, Yves Saint Laurent.
Oh my Balmain. Gosh, thank you for saying that. Like Yves Saint Laurent, for me, it's like criminal that they have changed the logo. Like I know I should not say that, but it's just... That was like almost, you know, like it's such a heritage logo. It's such a heritage piece. It just like, it was kind of like this design marvel. And I'm so devastatingly sad that they have decided to tone down and water down into this mass consumption idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know it's a very opinionated idea, but what I just cannot help but think that.
But way. I feel the same as you, you know. I was like, but why are you just want to be the same as you used to be, unique and have your own heritage? Now you are just like leaving everything to please. I don't even know who you want to please with that, but.
Completely agree.
But if we could remember one thing about branding, is that you need to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Different yourself. And so we were talking about what you did after your PhD.
Yeah, so last summer I have co-founded a think tank called Fashion Forward with a colleague of mine whose name is Doris Domosley-Landner. She is a fashion archivist and fashion historian. And we... We're working on this exhibition, the sustainable exhibition, last year. And we kept on coming up with all these different ideas that are not currently part of the fashion discourse, but they should be. And we just kept coming up with more and more themes over time. And at one point we looked at each other and we said like, hey, you know, I mean, it's, we cannot fit all these ideas in the year, but we should find the different frameworks where we can. And so we started thinking what would be the best framework for that. And we decided on a fashion think tank, which would allow us essentially to create different media forms, from white papers to exhibitions and symposiums, where we can provide these different new ideas that are challenging the system, that are overlooked, that are neglected, and that can make fashion a little bit more diverse, interesting, just, you know, like pump new life into it.
And could you give an example of a few ideas?
Absolutely. So, for example, we have started our symposium series last November, and we are planning on the fourth symposium. And our last symposiums, we have included wonderful speakers on digital fashion, for example, which is a new area, and there's still not a lot of information on it. And then we had one symposium where we were tackling diversity in a way that we had one speaker who was talking about racial representation, one about disability, one specifically we had one designer who was tackling prosthesis garments for amputees and body positivity. And then our last symposium covered sustainability from non-Western perspectives, because one thing is that sustainability tends to be approached from a very Western Eurocentric perspective. And it's really a shame, because sustainability is not a new concept and it has been at the root of many, many cultures and their fashion practices as well. So we had one indigenous designer from Canada who is called Dustin LeGrande. He is behind the brand Mobilize. And then we had Mukul Bhatia from India. He is a fine art photographer and sustainability activist. And then finally, we had Rabbi Ansana, who is a cross-cultural expert, and she is an entrepreneur working in between West Africa and Japan, and happened to live in Paris. So, like, she also has a super diverse background. So we had speakers who were coming from extremely different background, had this non-Western perspective on what sustainable fashion was. And so we are trying to bring in these very different colorful ideas. Our next one is going to be on AI, artificial intelligence, and fashion sustainability.
Which I is can't a very... wait.
Oh, yeah. I really hope that you or whoever listens to this podcast will come, because this is a program that our aim is really to make this very overwhelming and very intimidating subject just something that is understandable for people who are not necessarily in technology or digital world. I mean, I think for us, we're more socially inclined and more creatively inclined, is essential to have the same kind of material available but presented in different ways. And I think that's what we are really doing with Fashion Forward.
That's so interesting. And where do you see Fashion Forward in, like, in 5 years?
So I really hope that in terms of the content that we are putting out, we are not going to be that different. I mean, we do organize symposiums. We have been presenting at conferences. We have been working on a sustainable city guide series and programming that go with that. We are putting together our first magazine. We have a lot of things going on, but I hope that one thing that we can change in 5 years is to get stronger, to get more funding that would allow us to get more people involved, to compensate people better, to delegate some of these skills, because I think one thing that is very difficult when you do a business on your own is that you have to wear so many hats. You really have to be your lawyer and accountant and strategist and social media person. And, you know, like, it's a lot for one person.
Yes.
And we are very lucky because we have a wonderful network of people who are helping us continuously. I think our goal is to keep this programming going, but also to be able to involve them more, and being able to compensate them more, and just to reinforce these initiatives.
And now you have a co-founder, that's right?
Yes. So essentially, we are, Doris and I, we do majority of our programming, but we do have some wonderful advisors who have had a very long and very successful career in fashion and design who are helping us. We do have design partners who do help us with our website and some of our external platforms. We have programming partners who collaborate with us on several projects. I mean, we do have help. And I think one of this aspect that I did not see coming was this wonderful sense of community, that people are reaching out with ideas and just, you know, yeah, just like wonderful ideas and how to move forward and what we could do together. And we love those ideas. We love, it's such a vitalizing force of energy to be able to connect with people with different backgrounds and different initiatives and see, you know, like what is the intersection where we could do something together.
And I think that's even more interesting because you launched your project in a pandemic time. So it must not have been the best time of the world, I think.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting because we did launch it during the pandemic. But I think when you're setting up a new organization, there are several phases and there are several stages. And I think the first 6 months of our existence, we were really aggressively focusing on laying down a foundation of programming. Because, you know, like you cannot get funding and you cannot get grants if you don't have a footprint. You need to prove that you are capable to organize symposiums and conferences and put together a publication. So we are really, really heavily focusing on proving that. And I think we have, I mean, we just had an article for Glamour coming out yesterday. We do have the symposium series we talked about. We do have guides. We do have reports available on our webpage. So that was the first half of the year. I think we are now in this second phase where we are seeking to amplify our voice and get more PR and media partners and to get our ideas and voices out there. And I think from about, you know, like a mid next year, we are going to be able to focus more on funding that really got the backseat until now.
Yes, I hope. And we'll be able to follow you. I'll put all the links in the description of the podcast. And to wrap up this extremely interesting and inspiring like part about your career, I have two last questions. The first one is, who are the three people who have been the most influential to you?
I think the first one is my mother.
And why?
Is this, oh my gosh, my mom is the best. She is just crazy courageous, selfless. I mean, she can take everything on her shoulder and fight through, and she's fearless and warm at the same time. And she is just like a wonderful role model to have. I'm extremely lucky. And then I think second is my husband. He is somebody whose partnership means the world to me. And I think we continuously inspire and back each other, which has been extremely meaningful and fortunately rare to have that experience. And third, let me think about somebody from their work side. It's difficult to choose somebody, just one person from work, because yeah,
I mean, people were like, why you didn't choose me?
Yeah, and also like, I cannot like commit like one person. Like I feel like, I mean, does it, you know, I mean, yeah, I'm gonna make my own rules. Like I cannot come up with one person, if I want to be honest, because now I'm thinking about, you know, like we have a mentor, Sam Daviard, who is just, you know, like the most wonderful, inspirational thinker who is just thinking outside the box so much, and she has such a warm heart too. And I think honestly, like for me, somebody who has been an influence on me need to have several characteristics, and one of them is just compassion and warmth. And that needs to be matched with wisdom and intelligence and humor. So, I mean, I think like those three characteristics are yielding people who are very strong and capable, and just we need more of those in the world.
Good answer. You didn't say a third person, but we know that it's everyone who has those three characteristics.
Yes. That's interesting. That's right.
And the last one is because I guess that even though you have a very inspiring career, it's ups and downs. And the question is, what is your biggest failure and what did you learn from it?
I mean, I don't experience a failure as, you know, like one. I mean, I feel like my daily life is full of failures and successes. I mean, I have been sending out, I think, zillions of emails to people who have not answered. But then, you know, like you get 3% back and sometimes you just have one. Change needs one person. I mean, all failure is that either it was not the right time to do something or you just have stretched your wings too much and you were just not there. I mean, I know this is not a very satisfactory answer in some ways, but I'm kind of trying to approach this topic from a way of let's ignore failure and let's just try things and see like what's going to happen. Sometimes it's going to be humiliating and sometimes it's going to be extremely stressful and sometimes it's, you know, the bottom line is that as long as you're trying, as long as you're staying in the movement, things are going to be fine. It's just, you know, everything comes down to this idea that you have got to stay in the movement. Failures do not define you. I think when you're not staying in the movement, that's when you get failures that are very big and they become traumatic and that are hard to overcome because you're not used to failures. Failure should almost be part of your everyday life.
And it is. And actually, I love your answer on this question because I think never a failure, always a lesson. You know, there's a quote that says that. And as you said, I think that the biggest failure is just to stay at the same place and not move at all. Because if you want to go further and you stay at the same place, you don't do any moves, you will never improve or evolve. And
And then like once you're trying, and then you do fail, then it's going to be so big that it's going to be so difficult to overcome. Like then it will be a thing like, okay, you have to work on overcoming it. Failure should almost be like something that like comes on a regular base.
It's part of success, actually.
It really is.
It is the condition. You know, there's this quote I love. I think it's Winston Churchill. He says that success is going from failures to failures with no loss of enthusiasm.
Oh, I love that. It's true. Yeah, I love that. I haven't heard it before.
So I love your answer on this question. So if we come to the next part, which is all about your inspirations and the main subject of the podcast, which is modesty, who would be the three designers or brand who incarnate your vision of modesty in fashion?
So I think it's kind of a funny thing because my favorite and my most inspirational brands are tend to be brands that I work with at the time. I guess because like I get that human aspect. But one of my favorites now is a brand called Alma. A-L-M-A. Yeah, she's really, really a wonderful designer. She is... she's extremely modest, both in her personality and in her fashion design. And I think her personality and design translates of what I appreciate in modesty, and that is very quiet and very smart. She thinks about every single garment in ways how to limit the fabrics that is needed to use by employing interesting garments, interesting techniques, and interesting folding techniques. And she sews every single item with her mom. Sometimes a seamstress, if they're really running out of time. But there is this human element that I find also very modest. That, you know, like she has been called out by Forbes. She has been presenting at international fashion weeks. Nevertheless, she is not, you know, too big to sew her own garment. I love that. Like, what is modesty if not that?
I love that too. Especially, I didn't know that brand. So thank you for this beautiful discovery.
Yeah, I mean, they're actually opening their web shop early April, because so far they have been doing a lot of made-to-order, but they are switching to the web shop system, which is super exciting.
And it's an American brand?
Or? No, actually, she's Hungarian.
Oh, that's even more interesting.
Yeah, so I'm very excited about that brand. But I do believe, just returning to your question, for me, modest, interesting brands are rooted in community, or brands that tend to be rather small. There's another Hungarian brand who I was training. It's called Borbala. She is taking this idea of community and upcycling materials for a Black Friday. Her project is that she is giving out complimentary, how do you call the sample you use to sew a piece. She has some of these wonderful, wonderful tops, top designs, and she, for Black Friday, gave us, you know, like the model, the blueprint for it, so everybody can make that garment, which is also super nice, I thought. But modesty, like, definitely comes down to this idea that you are not bigger than the system. You know your place, you know your community, and you're helping them in a lovely way.
That's so beautiful. And do you have a third one in mind?
Third one? I don't even know. I would say that third one is all the artisans that may not have an actual label, but who are making clothes every day, and they don't need a label sticked into the garment, who are just creating high quality garments, and who are repairing also, which should be more and more the job of brands, not to consider, you know, like the end of the cycle, the consumption, but also how to keep those garments for a long time.
That's so inspiring. I love your unconventional answers.
Thank you.
And if we talk about artists, who would be your favorite artists that incarnate modesty in their work?
You know, so like when you told me about the podcast, Special Interest in Modesty, and it's linked to the art world, I was thinking about it so hard. And I came to this realization that I think it's just too difficult to answer that one. I mean, I don't have, I mean, because art is so much, I mean, I could say that, you know, like, I think every time when there are new ideas introduced, there is a type of modesty in there. And also paired with a type of loudness, confidence and modesty, it's an interesting form how they can mix into one another. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it's that is still difficult for me. That is yet to be out.
And do you think confidence and modesty are together or not?
I think they can be together, definitely. I think it's okay to know your value, but also not to rub it into people's faces. I mean, I think it's you are confident when you know who you are in the world, what you can give, but not overconfident. Not believing that you know everything and you know things better. Mm. I think it's okay to know your value. And once you know your value, you can give other people the light and you can help other people to shine more so, because you don't need to prove so much. Mm. You're clear on what you can give.
Mm. That's interesting. I love what you are saying. And is there a fashion or art exhibition that you went to that just left you speechless?
Oh my gosh, yeah, so many. But I think the last one that I went was actually in Paris.
Interesting. So it was not in the lockdown time.
So, you know, it was actually during the lockdown, but before. So it was in October. And that was at the Musée des Arts Décoratifs.
Yes.
And there was an exhibition on luxury, which is my PhD topic. And it was just, I mean, really, really breathtaking to go through hundreds of years of material culture, essentially, and to see how in different cultures, material culture reflected exquisiteness. And I think also because it was during the time of lockdown, it was a little bit like, or partial lockdown, I would say, it was a bit like fresh air of just, you know, like being faced with artisanal goods that strive to create sublime.
That's interesting. And do you remember the exact name of the exhibition?
I think it was called Luxe.
Ah, Luxe, just Luxe. Okay, yep. Interesting.
And I think it's going to be on until July. So once everything is going to be backed up, it's going to be available again.
Yeah, I hope so. And do you read a lot?
Oh, yeah, I love to read. My husband is actually... It's like kind of like this ongoing joke that, you know, like there is not enough space for books anymore. So I love to read, and I love to read all sorts of literature. I mean, I'm like into everything from Dostoevsky to Harry Potter.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
And your favorite books ever?
Oh, man. Such a difficult question.
And don't tell me books that have this quote, this characteristics in the text.
Okay. I mean, just, you know, one example of something that I really love is Boris Vian, Froth on the Daydream. I love that one. I love Milan Kundera. Delight, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. I also really love that one. I love The Lover by Marc Durin. Oh, too many. I cannot choose just one.
But you prefer romantic stories?
I love romantic stories too. I love gothic stories too.
And business and biography books.
I think like I'm more into fiction. I'm trying to keep up a little bit with biographies, some nonfiction, but I think like my weakness is really fiction.
Mm.
I just love this idea of being transported into different worlds.
Mm. And do you use social media a lot?
You know, last year I had a breakup with social media for a while. I kept my Facebook because it helps me stay in touch with some people, and my LinkedIn for work. But I have completely erased Instagram because I had a difficult relationship with it. And then when we started Fashion Forward, Doris at one point told me, okay, Sarah, get your butt back. Like, you need to install Instagram and, like, get up with it, you know? So I did that. And right now I feel like it's under control. I don't use my personal Instagram profile that much. I definitely do use it. But for Fashion Forward, I mean, you know, like, I feel communication happens on these platforms, so you don't no longer really have the choice if you want to stay on people's minds.
So you try to use it for work only and moderate your consumption.
Yeah, although I think so somehow organically, I no longer use Instagram for a very, very personal reasons. I mean, I do have personal connections in my inbox. And I do share some personal pieces of my life, but I'm not posting very often. And I seldomly check my feed. Maybe, you know, like a few times a week. I definitely use Instagram Messenger, which I love these social media messengers that are helping you to stay in touch with people. For a long time, I think one of the underrated aspects of social media is the fact that you can just stay in touch with people in a very effortless way. So yes. Even when you don't talk with each other for even like 4 or 5 years, you still know of each other and you're updated. And it provides you a platform where you can be very spontaneous and just, you know, reach out almost randomly with two lines without providing a very extended explanation of what is going on in your life. But hey, are you in town? Do you want to get a drink? You know, just like getting right to the chase.
Yes, that's so true. And how do you keep inspired and feel your creativity on a daily basis?
I think during the lockdown, it's not always easy because you are surrounded with the same physical space, with the same people, and it's, you can only be inspired if you get a lot of different inputs. But one thing that really helped me, I think, like especially with Fashion Forward, is to seek out new people's opinion on certain subjects, to be collaborating with different people, even if, you know, it's something very experimental, even if it is an idea that may not work, that may not have any funding. I mean, that's, I think, like how inspiration works, is to pass on these different ideas, and one idea will breed another and so forth.
That's interesting. And I had a last part about the last positive thoughts, but I think you kind of answered it throughout our conversation. But I'll just ask you the question, if you have something else to add, is what actions could we do or undertake as individuals and company to make a positive impact on society, maybe through fashion and creativity?
I think in the end of the day, this comes down to a very, very simple idea. And that is to treat others how you would like them to treat you. I think we oftentimes forget about it because we do live in, most of the time, urban spaces where there's a lot of things going on. You meet too many people and you don't have the time to analyze every single interaction. But I think once you are able to handle people in a way that they would, that you wish for them to handle you, things cannot be that bad, you know? Our definition may differ on what sustainability is, what good and bad are. But we do have this very innate human feeling of how we want to be treated and how we want to treat others. And that needs to be aligned.
That's so beautiful. And actually, I have two last questions. The first one is there someone, maybe a public figure or someone famous who created a company or did something that impacted the world that inspires you? And who is this person and why does this person inspire you?
I guess Michelle Obama is, you know, like a very obvious answer to this, but I think like she's definitely inspiring for me and to a lot of people because she was able to intertwine wisdom and kindness and femininity and tradition and modernity and, you know, just cultures and subcultures in a way that is a very positive, that is a very inclusive way of doing it. Mm-hmm. I think she has been empowering and very inclusive for many, many groups, mainstream and minority alike, which is, I think, like really great because right now we are living, especially with digital, in a world where communities are becoming increasingly fragmented. And there is this idea that we need to focus on narratives that define us, experiences that define us, but not the other. And I get that. I think it's important to acknowledge those. But at the same time, it is also important to find common ground. Because if we don't find that, then it's very difficult to relate to those different experiences. And I think what Michelle Obama is doing is a finding common ground in between people by, you know, her programs and her speeches, but even, you know, like in the way she's dressing.
Yes.
It's very telling. She's very elegant, but she is wearing, you know, like fast fashion and designer fashion, American fashion and non-American fashion, white fashion and black fashion. You know, it's just like she mixes everything. And with that, she creates a common platform where she embraces people in general, you know?
Yes.
And I think that that's, I just love that embracing feeling because we need to have a common platform in order to, you know, respect and celebrate differences. Because if we only see differences and there is no love, then it only breeds hostility and misunderstanding.
So at the end, I would say it's celebrating the human being.
Yes.
Because we are all humans.
Yes. And like really, truly with love.
Yes, yes, of course.
Yeah.
And what is your favorite quote or the quote that you live by?
I don't know. I really liked yours from today. Maybe I will take that.
No, you can't steal mine.
Maybe I will ask your permission.
So maybe you have another one if you have another one in mind.
Oh, man. I mean, I think one quote that I kind of enjoyed these days is a Mahatma Gandhi quote to you, which is, you know, there is no beauty in the finest clothes if it makes hunger and unhappiness. And I think like that's kind of like fitting the idea of modesty and fashion. Because indeed, you know, like no matter how beautiful something is, if, you know, like there were tears behind it, if, you know, like there were fragmentations behind it, then how can you have joy?
That's true. That's a beautiful way to end our conversation. And if people want to connect with you or learn more about you, where can they find you? How can they contact you?
So they can find me on the Fashion Forward website, which is fashionforward.io, or our Instagram page, which is Fashion Forward Think Tank. Fashion Forward _ Think Tank.
Okay, I'll put all the links in the description. And really, thank you very much for this conversation. Really.
Oh, no, thank you, Diane. It was so much fun.
Yes, and so interesting and inspiring. And I wish you the best, and I will follow your project. And maybe next year we could do another podcast together to know where your project, how your project evolves.
I would absolutely love that.
So thanks again, and have a good day.
Thank you, Diane. You too.
Bye.
Bye.